Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Well, here we are back in the virtual studio for part B of How Much Can I Borrow? It's always great to see you too. And I'm super excited that we're very familiar with this already, so we can just roll straight into the second half. But before we do, let's talk about our market updates. Pete.
Kate, I was watching the news last night and very interested to hear that the price of iron ore has dropped by 30% since the end of July. And one of our listeners actually emailed us from Perth to give her opinion on that, which was great. We love our listener feedback. So I quickly went on to CoreLogic, and I can see if we look at the daily index, but I must admit I don't put as much trust in the daily index as I do in the other measurements, like over a quarter or a year. But when you look at the daily index, Perth is the only capital city in the red. Now, I'm not saying that that's because price of iron ore has dropped by 30%, because when you look at it over the whole year, Perth has been the worst performing capital city. When I say worse, it's done 11% for the year to date, which is very good. But compared to Sydney, which has done, say, 20% or Brisbane, 19%, it's been the worst performing out of any major capital city for the whole year. So the price of iron ore dropping certainly did not help Perth's case so far as the economy is concerned or the property market. So either way, you know, whatever the reason or reasons, probably more than one, looks like Perth is flattening out.
Interesting insight, and always handy when we've got listeners that give us their tips from the coalface as well.
The enigma wrapped in a riddle, Pete.
That's the one, Dave. That's the one.
It was interesting that our reader also thought that the hard border closures by McGowan has played a significant part in that.
No doubt.
Yeah, because they can't get interstate workers, can they?
Mm.
Yeah.
Amazing. Dave, what about your insights? What's going on in your marketplace this week?
Yeah, well, the July job figures have just come out and unemployment rate has dropped to 4.6%, which is the lowest rate since 2008, so since the global financial crisis, which you would think is a good thing, but it's actually the numbers underneath the unemployment rate that are actually more important. With the lockdowns that are occurring, although employment in New South Wales fell by 0.9%, the participation rate fell by 1%. So more people gave up job hunting than got jobs. So that means about 64,000 people exited the labour market. So they're not picked up in the unemployment stats. One of the IFM Investors chief economist believes the effective unemployment rate is really about 6%.
Interesting. And how many of those would you think are early retirees or retirees just pressing the go button?
I wouldn't come up with a percentage because I'm just not that across these types of numbers to be able to suggest a number. But obviously that would be a high percentage. And I wonder how much is also younger casual workers who are just saying, look, I'm going to take some time off until the lockdown ends. So it'll be interesting to see that sort of the breakdown between those different cohorts. What do you think, Kate and Pete?
I think there's, re-education, a lot of that going on, because in COVID when things are tough and there is an opportunity to study online, I think a lot of young people have taken advantage of that. And, yeah, I don't have the figures either, but it will be an exciting one to look at, because COVID's challenged a lot of people's thinking around, you know, the grinds of the day-to-day job. And I think a lot of people have considered, well, how can I use this time effectively? And for some, it's reskilling.
Yeah, and it's not just people wanting to study. It's also university and other institutions catering to that need, because I know many universities have dropped their ATAR or their entry level to get into university.
Right.
One, because there are a lot less international students, so we've got to encourage more domestic students. And I know because many people would know that I'm the chairperson of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia. We run a course for those that want to be property investment advisors. The enrolments in that have gone through the roof. So I think people have found that they've got a bit of spare time. Here's an opportunity either to upskill or maybe look for a different career. So there are it certainly does produce some great opportunities for people.
My market update this week is actually about what things look like for our capital cities that are in lockdown when we come out. Because as we all know, the spring season in the real estate market is usually the really buoyant, exciting one. And a lot of agents have been planning for spring for quite a while with their vendors, and they've had campaigns banking up and they've allocated auction dates, etc. Now, because of the extended lockdowns, we've been watching agents pushing all of their dates back, and of course they're banking up. And what we're hearing about now is agents proposing that they have very short timeframes to their campaigns. So we can anticipate we might have some 2-week auction campaigns when we get out of this, because for any vendor who wants to sell this side of Christmas, their agent is limited to, you know, how many properties they can advertise and market at any one time. So it'll be an interesting one to watch.
I've also noticed here, Kate, that even though properties are going to auction and there's a 3-week campaign, like, stuff sells within a few days. Yeah, people giving amazing offers after the first open, the vendor accepting them, you know, within a few days of the property hitting the market, it's gone, done and dusted.
And if there's ever an opportunity for a buyer to take advantage of the pressure that agents are going to be under, it will be coming into this spring market, because there will be agents and vendors that are saying, yeah, let's just get moving really quickly. And for some vendors, if it's a strong enough offer, it might not necessarily represent the offer that they might have got on auction day, but if it's a solid offer and they're fearful about being locked up again with COVID lockdowns, they'll be more likely to consider taking an offer prior to auction. So I think buyers really need to be prepped and ready, make sure they've got their finance approved so that they can pivot really quickly if someone else puts a property on the market early.
Very interesting times indeed.
For all you budding property planners out there, at Property Planning Australia, we are looking to hire a new property planner. So if you live in Melbourne, have a passion for helping people make educated and superior property, mortgage and money management decisions, we would love to hear from you if you have at least 5 years of experience working as a fully qualified financial planner. If that sounds like you, please send us a copy of your CV to info@propertyplanning.com.au. You can also give us a call if you like on 1300 896 045.
Now, I'm looking forward to getting back into our second part of this particular episode, because Dave talked us through assessment rates and LVR and used lots of compelling examples just to highlight all of the moving parts when it comes to assessing a loan application and telling a borrower what they can borrow. But we've only scratched the surface. So Dave, I'm handing over the baton to you to chat about variable incomes and how that plays a role in the assessment process.
Yeah, so I'll try not to drop the baton when you hand it over to me. I think the US 4x100 meter team did in the
Olympics. Right. I was waiting for that. You've got a yellow card.
So variable incomes, a lot of people might be surprised. I would estimate from all our mortgage clients and, you know, 20 plus years, I'd say 8 out of 10 people have some form of variable income. So it's the norm. Most people have some variability in their income, whether it's overtime, commissions, bonuses, being self-employed, subcontracting. And the important thing to understand is not all variable income is equal. So most lenders will take a shading on variable income. They won't actually factor in 100% of your variable income. Now, that all could be as low as they might only factor in 50% of your variable income. They might factor in none of it, subject to how long you've been earning that variable income for. But there are some second-tier lenders who will take 100% of your variable income. And you know, just I'll just throw rental incomes into that equation as well, because you know, most mainstream lenders will be between, say, 70 to 80% of your rental income they'll actually use, factoring in, you know, a property not being tenanted for some period of time, and also obviously the costs of maintaining the property. Whereas there are some second tier lenders who will consider 100% of your rental income. So this is just another area where your borrowing capacity, the devil's in the detail, and it can make a real difference in your end purchase price, property strategy, and portfolio planning.
Absolutely. If you've got a client who comes to you, and let's say they're in a sales role where the weighting of their bonus payments is far greater than their salary, and real estate's a really good example of that. Real estate salespeople might be on a very small salary that really just, you know, keeps them clothed and fed, and the majority of their income is actually in their commissions. And you'll have lenders that you'll target for applicants like that to optimize their borrowing capacity. And if someone doesn't know this and they just go to a major and there's a heftier assessment rate there that inhibits them from borrowing what they could have got with someone who takes 100% of bonuses or a larger percentage, that's a really significant differential to the borrowing capacity.
Yeah, it can make a huge difference. One of the examples that comes to mind, and this was an expat as well, mining executive, whose overall package would sort of gross up to $800,000 or $900,000, but the actual base was only around $200,000, and then there was different tiered structures around bonuses and different incentives. So, you know, that borrowing capacity was significantly different from one lender to another. And there are only a few lenders who you could even really consider. The expat component made it complex as well, because it's tricky for expats. There's not too many lenders who will provide them with a sort of a like-for-like borrowing capacity. But, yeah, that was an example where you had sort of a double whammy of huge sort of bonus components plus being an expat.
Interesting. And expats aren't just disadvantaged when it comes to how the lender will consider the bonus payments, but also the LVR. Are you able to shed a bit of light on that?
Yeah, look, you know, it might be as low as 60 to 80% for some expats that a lender would be willing to consider. Some won't be willing to consider some expats at all. You know, it'll depend on also the currency you're being paid in, the country that they're working in. So, yeah, with expats, it's a whole nother kettle of fish.
It is indeed. And it just highlights the importance of a strategic mortgage broker who intimately understands the challenges that your category of employment and work type will attract in terms of scrutiny. You've really got to have someone who knows their stuff, because it's not the same as taking a PAYG Australian-based applicant on. It's very, very different.
The vanilla PAYG worker who has no variable income and gets the same salary every week, that is the dream loan application.
That's why they call it the vanilla deal. It's a funny saying. I remember when I first started in mortgage broking and I heard that phrase, vanilla, and it says it all. It's a much easier loan application to get through.
Plain white and delicious.
Yep, love it. Dave, I would like to talk to you now about interest only versus principal and interest, and, you know, how these policies differ and what the impact can be to borrowing capacity.
When APRA started making their changes around capping the number of interest only loans, capping the percentage of investment loans for the banks, which is no longer applies, but they also mandated the way interest only loans could be assessed. So previously, if you got a 30-year loan term and let's say 5 years of it was interest only, you were still assessed as if you were paying principal and interest over the 30 years. Whereas now, if you have a 5-year interest only period, then your actual borrowing capacity is assessed over the ability to repay a loan over 25 years. So your interest-only period will significantly, or depending on the period of the interest-only time frame, reduce your borrowing capacity. So one of the areas that can be tweaked with is the length of the interest only period. And sometimes, you know, you might need to look at taking a shorter interest only period to optimize your borrowing capacity, you know, and obviously your property strategy. So a 1 year interest only period, you're going to have a much higher borrowing capacity than if you have a 5 year interest only period.
That's interesting. I remember the first time that struck for me, and I was quite surprised. Obviously, I was right on the cusp of borrowing as much as I possibly could for my investment property at the time, and that kind of tells a story about how I used to roll. And I remember having an assessment come back saying, you've declined on the five-year interest-only loan term, but we'll offer you a two-year. And I was like, what's going on? This is really weird. Spoke to the assessor, and they just said, it's marginal for you, but at 2 years, when it's amortized over 28 years for your P&I component, it works. Now, the reality is I was refinancing and rolling my interest-only periods anyway, which is what a lot of investors do. It just means that your refinance period comes up sooner. You're not getting the full 5 years.
Yeah, but there is a risk that your borrowing capacity, because it is tight at that initial point, that you may not have the capacity to roll it over and you might be stuck on P&I, and that could impact the borrower. So that's the type of thing you need to think about as a borrower. You know, if you do go for that shorter interest only period, what happens if you can't roll it over? You've got to at least consider that, and obviously you would have, and you were confident, and, you know, you'd be aware as well, whereas a lot of our listeners may not be aware of that type of consideration for them to think about. And it's why you need to factor in, okay, it's affordable for me to be paying interest only today, but will it be affordable for me to pay principal and interest when the interest only period ends if I can't roll it over to another interest only loan?
Absolutely. And we all know that policies change, regulations can tighten. We saw that happen in 2016. And I'm a multi-property investor, and Pete, you would know all about this. When the lenders said, no interest only, or they'd give you a really unfavourable set of loan conditions if you wanted to push hard for it. In the end, we threw our hands in the air and said, we're not going to fight this any harder. It's P&I for now. And the forced savings, it affected a lot of households, a lot of investors, and it was a good thing. And we were able to drive down our loan balances where we had readjusted global LVRs that were much more attractive. And that was the entire basis for the recommendation at the time when APRA said we want to limit interest only. So you've always got to be mindful that even if you do think that you've got an interest only period to enjoy, that you've absolutely provisioned for what happens when it reverts to P&I, and you've got to look at your loan agreement and fully recognise exactly what sort of obligation you'll have dollar wise every month. Pete, I've got a question for you about interest only. What was your attitude towards interest-only lending, particularly in your early investor days, and how did you see that change over the decades?
So interest-only is what we went for because it helped with our cash flow. It allowed us to buy multiple properties. And depending on people's goals and their situation, I encourage all investors to go interest-only. But the last month or so, I've been refinancing. And there's two reasons. One, I'm 60 years old, so now's a good time to pay off some debt, because when I get to 65 or 70, I'd like to see that I have less debt than I have today, and I'm not planning on buying any more long-term hold investment properties. But the other reason is, you know, generally we can depend on the market to increase, and therefore what the property is worth compared to our debt, the gap is quite large. But I think after this boom period is over, the market is going to flatten out. So we won't see a lot of increased equity through property price increases. It'll have to be through debt reduction. So for two reasons, most of my loans now have gone to interest only. One, I can afford it because, you know, the rent coming in today is a lot higher than when I took out the mortgage 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So, you know, principal and interest is a lot more comfortable today than it was when we first bought the property. And, you know, because we're not buying any more, so I'm not really interested in the ability to buy more, then I also want to go principal and interest. But for those younger investors listening, you know, speak to your property investment advisor, speak to your strategic mortgage broker. But if you can get interest only, which will then allow you to buy, you know, another property, I think that's a great way to go. What do you think, Dave? Strategic mortgage broker? Is that correct or not?
Look, I think that's all a good approach, Pete. You're moving towards that stage of transitioning to retirement. Don't want to put you into retirement too early, but it certainly makes sense to be trying to retire some debt. And then obviously relative to the amount of debt you have, you know, what your broader property plan would be as you transition and whether you might divest one asset to totally be debt-free, you know, as you scale back your employment into a more flexible sort of stage of life with your working hours. But yeah, it, obviously it's about tailoring it to each individual circumstances, but what you've just described makes total sense.
I like what you said there, Dave. If you're looking to retire, you should also look to retire your debt, because if you're looking to live off the rent, well, you want to have minimum or like either zero debt ideally or very minimum debt. Because when you're on a fixed income, you know, whether it's your super or whatever it might be, if you've got a large amount of debt, then it can be a little bit scary, especially if interest rates rise, right? How's your income going to increase to help pay for those interest rate rises? So in your retirement, you would be, I think, better off either having no debt or very little debt compared to your equity, just as a buffer against any future interest rate rises.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, and it's a great example of how you're still continuing to make financial decisions throughout that transition stage to retirement and into retirement, because if you're a multiple property owner.
Yeah, most definitely.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Dave, you've got some really good points here that you've covered, and they're intriguing points that vary from loan offering to loan offering. Can I ask you to step our listeners through them?
Just a few points and some of the different policies between the lenders of with interest only versus principal and interest. You know, so for example, for interest only loans, most of the majors allow you to go to 90% loan to value ratio on investment loans only, whereas some of the non-majors only allow interest only repayments up to 80%. So, you know, also the loan to value ratio into your repayment type is going to have a potential impact on the lender you can select. So, you know, that might sound a little bit complex, but just to say that again, your repayment type, whether you choose interest only or principal and interest, your strategy type, whether it's investment or owner-occupy, and then your LVR, whether it's under 80% or above 80%, those three factors are going to limit or increase the number of lenders that you have access to.
It's an amazing consideration when there are so many facets. I remember it back in my broking days, we'd do scenario workshops. The whole team would be sitting around a big table and someone would put up a case study, a real life case study of a client they were working with who obviously had complexity and things that we had to consider and work around. And you'd have your panel of lenders in your head and it was kind of like playing that guess who game. You know, they'd say, oh, yeah, self-employed. Oh, okay, well, you can't do this. And you'd be knocking over all of these lenders. And ultimately, you know, in a lot of cases, you're just down to one, maybe two loan products, two lenders. And the value of a broking service where there is a panel of lenders and someone who can consider all of those different policies is really vital, because if that applicant walked into a bank, it would be a really unlikely chance that there'd be a loan product there for them.
Yeah, and there's probably a correlation between your earlier years where you have less savings and as you're accumulating properties, so you're taking greater risk, you've got a multi-property strategy, that these types of complexities are more at play. Someone like Pete, he might have taken a guess, but he might have been with the same lender for 15 years.
50.
How long?
Oh, Pete, I love your predictability.
So, you know, Pete, when we talk about some of these complexities, he's going, what are you talking about? I've just been with the same lender for 40 years.
I've stayed with the NAB. My parents opened a savings account when I was a little kid with the NAB, and the vast majority of my loans have been with the NAB. Now, That's probably wrong, isn't it, Dave? But
so Pete's cost himself hundreds of thousands of dollars.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, that's so sweet. What clawback?
You're the perfect client for a strategic mortgage broker, Peter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, a broker does get a new upfront commission each time they refinance as well. So, look, we certainly, you know, there's no right or wrong. You've got to do what you're comfortable with and someone's would prefer. And certainly as we get older, the hassle increases of moving. You know, the more properties you own, the more kids you have, you know, the more offsets you have. It's a bigger hassle to move from one lender to another. There'd definitely be a correlation between younger, move more often, older, move less.
Yeah, no, it's a serious inconvenience to put a new application together. And we all know just how testy and difficult the lenders are as well. You can assume that you've uploaded every single supporting document and they'll always come back and ask you to verify something else.
We talked last week how important it was to have a great relationship with your bank manager, your local bank manager, because they were going to be the ones that really determined whether you got the loan or not. Mm. But even today, for me, it's relationships which is really important. I don't chase the cheapest interest rate, but I want to know that when I ring a number, I'm not going to talk to some automated message, but I'm either going to get my relationship manager or their PA, or if I do leave a message, they'll get back to me within the day. For me, it's convenience because, you know, I'm just so busy, I don't have the time to chase the best. It's like, you know, I was speaking to my wife yesterday and I said, darling, we should have a look at health insurance. You know, maybe we need to change because we've been with the same health insurer for 30 years. And she just rolled her eyes. She said, do you know how much work is involved to work out changing health insurance? And it's a bit like banks, as you say, Dave, you know, to change all the loans, to change all the accounts that the tenants put their rent in.
But it's also a perfect example because the relationships now are primarily with strategic or mortgage brokers. And that's a key difference between mostly dealing with banks. And often with banks, you've got staff changing over every couple of years, whereas the successful long-term strategic mortgage brokers, is, you know, they're doing it for a long time. So you've got that one point of contact. But also, they are actually looking at the market for you. You know, you don't have to go and look at the market like your wife was shaking her head at, Pete, about health insurance. The strategic mortgage broker will look at the market for you. And there's a value to that, even though we don't associate a value to getting a mortgage because we don't actually hand over a fee, because all the fees actually bundled into your interest rate and the fees you pay to the lender. There's still a fee that gets paid, but it's through the cost of your mortgage rather than a direct payment. And so relationship is one of the key reasons that more than half of all the mortgages in Australia are now done through mortgage brokers, and that number continues to climb.
Pro broker here. Now, Dave, I'm going to move us on to chat about lenders' mortgage insurance because you have got quite a bit of information here and it's a very, very relevant topic and it comes up a lot in conversation, and I'm always someone who will talk about the pros and cons of any scenario, but too many people are negative about LMI when I actually think it's an enabler.
Yeah, look, I agree. You know, lenders' mortgage insurance is definitely an enabler, often for first-time buyers. You know, as Pete touched on in the last episode, there's many countries whose economy and banking system isn't stable enough for their lenders to be able to offer loan-to-value ratios above 80%. Some won't go above 60%. So you've got to, you know, have significant savings to be able to even get into the marketplace in a lot of these countries. So lenders mortgage insurance allows you to get into the property market with a, you know, savings of as little as 5% plus stamp duty costs. And although it is a one-off, it's a one-off payment that protects the bank, not you, I agree, for most people, unless they're getting a significant support from parents or family, it's necessary for first-time buyers, and it can be necessary for people who want to develop, build an investment portfolio aggressively and not, you know, so therefore go into mortgage insurance, which is also tax deductible when it's paid for as part of purchasing an investment property.
Yeah, very much so.
I'd just like to point out for the first-time buyers or potential first-time buyers who might be listening, I'd like you to Google First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, because the government will go, if you've only got a 5% deposit, the government can guarantee the other 15%. Now, it's not available for everyone. I think they've only got 10,000 per year. But, you know, this is August, so the year's only just started. So my advice to you is, you know, you should apply earlier rather than later, because then that'll allow you to get into the market quicker. So rather than saving, say, minimum 5% deposit plus 5% for stamp duty and other costs, it's just the 5% deposit. So Google it, First Home Loan Deposit Scheme. Check it out.
Great tip, Hank.
Good tip. So an interesting example to just illustrate the point that you're making, Kate, about how it's an enabler. If you have $100,000 of savings, and let's say you have 100 plus the amount needed to cover stamp duty and fees to keep the numbers simple, if you try to keep your loan-to-value ratio at 80%, then you're limited to a purchase price of $500,000. Whereas if you had 100,000 plus stamp duty and fees but were willing to go to 90% loan-to-value ratio or higher, well, then you're able, subject to obviously your income, to purchase a property for $1 million. So that's a pretty stark difference, obviously, in the purchase price that you're able to access, because you've got the same amount of savings, give or take, but you're going to a 90% or above LVR rather than 80%. The price differential can be $500,000 in that example of what you're able to buy.
Yeah, very much so. And Dave, let's talk about the cost of LMI. Obviously, we can't talk specific cost because there are varying models, but just to give our listeners an overview.
Yeah, look, just to understand, essentially, the more you're borrowing, the more the mortgage insurance premium will increase and the higher the loan-to-value ratio. So, for example, obviously, if you're borrowing 80 to 85%, then you're less risk, so your premium is going to be lower than if you're borrowing 90 to 95%. So that does increase pretty significantly the higher your LVR goes up. So if you can, and it often ticks over perhaps every like 2 percentage points, so 82% LVR to 82.1, it then goes up in a percentage expense. So for example, every dollar in lending above 90% incurs about 40 cents in the dollar as a lender's mortgage insurance premium, whereas it's about 11 cents at 85 to 90. So if you tick over 90%, the cost becomes quite a lot higher. If you tick up to sort of 94, 95, it becomes significantly higher. So you can actually ask your strategic mortgage broker to give you examples at like 90%, 95, 85. And if you can reduce it, you might be able to save a fair chunk on your lender's mortgage insurance premium. But as Kate and I have just talked about, you don't want to cause it to stop you from making a really positive property decision that is going to enable you to grow your wealth and build an asset base because you were too focused on getting the loan-to-value ratio down too low. And obviously, you know, see what's happened in the market this year, delaying could already have cost you $100,000 or $200,000.
I think we always have to apply that pragmatic approach where we model out how long we think it will take us to save a certain amount. And without promoting any scary fear-mongering, we've got to be prepared to look at the pace of the market. And if we're in an aggressive seller's market, that time frame that you take saving up could really erode your ability to buy in the area that you want to buy in if you're being overly ambitious with how much you need to save. And LMI always has to be considered carefully because for some, they see it as a lost cost and it does create a little bit of upset for them, but I prefer to see it as an enabler when the situation calls for it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, history tells us that most of the time people can't save as much and as rapidly as the property market is increasing, and therefore the time taken to get to a point to get into the market, you know, the properties that you're able to purchase today, you know, it might push you to an inferior quality of dwelling or an inferior location.
So, Dave, while you were chatting, I just found an LMI calculator online.
I was wondering what you're up to.
Even though I'm a man, I can do two things at once. Not often, but sometimes I can. So I looked at a $500,000 house, and if you were borrowing $400,000, there's no LMI, right? But if you were borrowing $475,000, which means you're borrowing 95%, your LMI is $17,000, right? Now, that sounds a lot, but here's your choice. So you've got your $25,000 deposit, right, and you can pay an extra $17,000 in LMI, or you wait till you save $100,000 deposit. You know, what's it going to be? For me, I'd be paying the extra $17,000 and moving on. For me, that's just a cost of doing business.
It's a great example, and that extra $75,000 for the average first-time buyer, that could be another 4 years.
Yeah, because that's saving. Even if your salary was $75,000 a year, you've got to save $75,000 after tax. And property prices aren't going to wait for you to save. They're moving all the time.
Amazing. That was great insight, Peter. I was going to put you on the spot, but you've put yourself on the spot. You've zoned out. You're tic-tacking around on Google. Now, Dave, just to finalise our episode, I'd love to ask you to chat about the core difference between banks and non-banks.
Yeah, so a few of the key differences with banks and non-banks. If you're wanting to maximise borrowing capacity and purchase price, especially as a multi-property owner or investors with significant existing property and debt, then non-bank solutions will often provide a superior outcome with your borrowing capacity. Two, non-banks will have certain policy niches that can make them more attractive, subject to the complexity of your situation. Certainly non-banks or non-conforming lenders can cater to people with credit problems, the shorter term employed as well, and then also people with larger non-base incomes, as we've touched on today, more bonuses, commissions, overtime, allowance-based income. So there's some of the key differences. And just be mindful, you know, if you're paying a few percentage points higher, don't be too caught up on that. If it means that it's costing you achieving the home that you want to buy and hold for the mid to long term, or it's impacting your investment strategy, just make sure you're conscious of the choices that the lender choice you're making and how that's impacting your property strategy and property plan.
Great advice, Dave. I always think when you've got a product that is a particularly special and niche offering, even if you're paying a premium to have that product, it's better than no loan.
And, you know, but it also can be more nuanced than that. It might be the difference between a home that will last you until you retire versus a home you're going to have to sell in 7 years. Yeah. It might be the difference between buying that A-grade quality investment today or getting a B-grade investment. So, you know, it's definitely worth understanding the impact on your property strategy.
Nicely said. Now, on that note, we're about to say cheerio. Have you both got your gold nuggets?
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Pete, over to you.
Right, so I did that rough calculation on the LMI calculator, and it was a $25,000 deposit, plus if you paid $17,000, you cover your LMI. That sounds very easy, but if you listen to our episode last week, remember Dave said your interest rate also goes up. So the example that Dave gave was at an 80% lend or below, it might be 2.9%, but a 95% lend is 4.6%. So you're paying a higher interest rate. But it doesn't end there. It doesn't mean you have to pay that high interest rate forever. All you got to do is wait for the property value to increase so that your debt to equity ratio is less than 80%. Then you go to the bank and say, right, I'd like to refinance, please. And you should get that lower interest rate. And that's some work that your strategic mortgage broker can do. So talk to your strategic mortgage broker, because there's a lot of things other than the LMI and LVR. There's a lot of other things that we've talked about today, principal and interest, interest only, the difference between banks and non-banks. There's a lot, but it's worth the hassle. You know, if it means no home or a home, mate, it's certainly worth the hassle.
Nicely said, mate. Dave, what's your gold nugget?
My gold nugget is, for all this talk on borrowing capacity, you still want to make sure you understand what we call at Property Planning Australia your money goal. So how much money, how much surplus cash flow do you want coming through after you settle on your next purchase? And how much savings, access to funds, do you want to have available after your next purchase? Because they should be the barometers that drive your purchase price. Now, you need to understand your living expenses to be able to get to those numbers, but they are personal numbers. But if you know those numbers, then you can actually dictate the purchase price that you're comfortable with, and then make sure your strategic mortgage broker finds a lender that will allow you to borrow the amount to achieve that purchase price.
Wonderful. Now, I've got a sneaky little gold nugget to share myself.
That's a yellow card, Kate.
Yeah, I know, but I just thought it's a really good little tip because I've seen a lot of people get caught out with this. If and when you're refinancing or you're getting a new LVR that's resetting the loan that you're on, you'll most likely trigger a valuation. In a lot of cases, it's a real valuation where a valuer goes to a property. If you're doing this for your investment property, be very clear to tell your property manager or your tenant that it's for the purposes of refinancing. Because if the tenant doesn't know this and they've got a valuer knocking on the door, they will justifiably get a little bit anxious. And what you don't want to do is trigger a tenant vacating because they're fearful that you're thinking about selling your property. So always remember to think about your tenant if you're doing something like that.
Great tip.
Excellent. Take away the yellow card.
Yeah.
Nah, on that note. You're back on the field.
Yeah. I look forward to seeing you guys next time. I know we've got a really cool episode in store for our next recording. So until then, take care.
Should we give them a little sneak insight?
All right. Well, I'm happy to give a little bit of a clue. We're talking about agent behaviours. We covered off an episode on this a year and a bit ago, and we've got a part B up our sleeve. So we're busy putting together some fun notes. And we'll be able to share more when we go live next week. Take care of yourselves, guys. I look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about how an effective mortgage strategy is critical to wealth creation, take a listen to episodes number 9, Why Your Mortgage Strategy is More Important Than Your Interest Rate. Episode 24, How Mortgage Strategy Shapes Your Ability to Hold Property and How It Can Pay Off for Decades to Come. Episode 30, Money Management, 7 Steps to Success. Episode 34, No Mortgage Strategy, number 4 of the top 7 critical mistakes. Episode 48, Offset Accounts, God's Gift to Mortgage Strategy. And finally, Episode 87, Optimizing Tax Deductions, Top Mortgage and Loan Strategy Tips.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.